Good evening, Radioland, and welcome to Endeavors on CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, up atop the mountain here at Simon Fraser University. Of course, we are always on the internet as well at cjsf.ca. We stream and podcast all your favorite shows, as well as Endeavors and yours truly. And you can listen on TELUS HD, channel 7014. Hope you all had a happy Easter. Apologize, I was off last week. I was finishing up my last week ever of theater school here in Vancouver at Douglas College, and that is all done now, 2 years of that, so that's why it's been a little sort of, you know, 3 weeks on, 1 week off for a while here. But I'm back with full force, and I'm happy to be back here again and able to devote more attention to this show and to journalism and broadcasting and interviewing people and just finding people that have stories to tell, because everybody has a story to tell. Before we get to our interviews today, I want to give a special shout out to someone very, very special, someone very close to me. She turns 20 years old today. She's my best friend in the entire world. And yeah, so happy birthday to the lovely, the wonderful, the talented Miss Jessica Junto. Hope to see you soon. I love you. And all the best on your special day. All right. Now, to move on from that rather sappy shout out, we have two great guests today. My first guest is currently known for playing the sinister, the conniving, and the somewhat ambivalent and ambiguous, the man of ambiguous morals, Dr. Peter Farragut, on the hit sci-fi show Helix. For all you gamers out there, you may know him as the actor and voice behind Charles Lee in Assassin's Creed 3. But he was also in Assassin's Creed 3, The Tyranny of King Washington, and Assassin's Creed Black Flag as Dr. Case Fisher, and Assassin's Creed Unity as Victor and Hugo. He has also appeared in other TV series, such as The Listener, Zero Hour, and the Bullet in the Face, Blue Mountain State, and the miniseries Human Trafficking. He has appeared in such films as 300, X-Men, Days of Future Past, Immortals, and Riddick. He is Neil Napier. And he joined me on the phone earlier today. Neil Napier, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Dan.
So you are Dr. Peter Farragut on the sci-fi show Helix.
I am indeed.
Were you a fan of the genre before getting involved with this series?
I wouldn't say I was a hardcore fan. I do definitely have an interest. I mean, one of my favorite movies of all time was John Carpenter's The Thing. I don't know if you remember that from the early 80s.
Yeah,
that's one of my favorite. I must have seen that when I was in my early teens, a good dozen times. And so, yeah, there are a few few sci-fi films and TV shows that I was definitely a fan of. I couldn't justifiably call myself a fan of the genre. That would be doing a disservice to the fandom out there.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. Like, more so than any other genre or sort of any other type of art, is the sci-fi, the fandom of sci-fi is unlike anything you'll ever experience. Since being a part of Helix, what have you noticed about the fandom of both the show in particular and of sci-fi in general?
Well, I've gotten to know the fandom, like become more acquainted with the phenomenon of sci-fi fandom. I've been to a few Comic-Cons in the last couple of years, and my interaction on Twitter with Helix fans specifically and sci-fi fans in general, they are really detail-oriented. They're passionate about whatever it is they're following, and they know the mythology and the origin stories of the characters. And I think they really do, they see the allegory in it to our lives, to us as a society. And I think that's a big part of the draw to it.
Whenever I talk to actors in sci-fi shows, they always talk about if they've had any odd or strange fan encounters. Have you experienced anything like that since you've become a part of that world?
I'm not sure if I've had any odd encounters with fans. I'm pretty sure fans have had some odd encounters with me. No, I've been really fortunate, and most people I've spoken to, friends of mine in kind of the same position, have been really fortunate to have pretty much universally positive experiences when interacting with the fans. People so far have been really supportive, really curious and inquisitive about what's going on with the show. I've seen some really interesting cats at Comic-Cons. You know, some of those cosplayers are just amazing. And seen some really pretty fabulous artists who shine in that milieu. But in terms of kind of crazy or negative experiences, I really can't think of any.
How would you describe your character of Peter? It seems like we're never really sure whose side he's on in a lot of ways.
Yeah, he's his allegiances are somewhat liquid. Do you know what I mean? I've always thought of him as a man in search of a purpose, in a way. He's ambitious, and he's jealous, but he also has a great capacity for love. So he's got a lot of different things within him, pulling him in different directions. So it's definitely a challenge to try to play that guy, to keep all those different motivations kind of humming underneath the surface. He's a really conflicted fella. And he's got a lot of different agendas in the air at any time.
And how would you describe his relationship with his brother, Alan, played by Billy Campbell?
Complicated. Very complicated. There's a lot of love in there, I think. If we look back to the first season, we got some of the information about their early childhood and their relationship with their alcoholic abusive father and the loss of their mother to cancer. So they definitely bonded in a lot of ways, but I think one of the most salient facts of their relationship is that Alan is the golden boy and Peter has always lived in his shadow. So I think that's where a lot of the covetousness and the jealousy comes from for Peter. But I do think there's a love underneath there. It's just, as we've gone over season one and season two, it's become kind of blackened and perverse.
But hey, it must be nice to say that you get to play the brother of Billy Campbell.
Oh my God, it's an honor and a joy. He is he's such a great, I actually met him in Vancouver for the first time about 2 years ago at the Fan Expo, because my wife and I were presenters at the Canadian Video Game Awards 2 years ago in Vancouver. And we met him there, and we ended up going out to dinner with Victor Lucas, who runs Electric Playground and is one of the organizers of the Canadian Video Game Awards. And he was friends with Billy. And we all went out to dinner on the Sunday after the Fan Expo and everything was done. It was my first time chatting with him. And he was such a nice guy. And, you know, he spoke about sailing. We spoke about rugby that we both play. And when we left, we were on the sidewalk and everybody walked away and said goodnight. My wife and I were standing there and I watched them walk away. And I remember saying to my wife, wow, that Billy Campbell is a super guy. Man, I hope I get to work with him one day. And then about 3 months later, I booked the role of his brother on Helix. So it's pretty fortunate.
One thing I find interesting about the show is that Cameron, the creator, has come out and said that unlike a show like Lost, they're not going to predominantly use flashbacks as a way of telling the story. How do you find the writing style of Helix compared to maybe some other shows or sci-fi shows that you've seen?
It's definitely complex because the stories that are intertwining, especially in the second season, are complex. And I think the writers do a great job in weaving it all together. Because things are constantly changing. There's nothing procedural about this show, right? There's nothing that, you know, there's one case 1 week and another case the next week while following a few storylines that carry throughout the season. Everything is always in flux all the time on Helix. So that's an incredible challenge for a writing room to stay on top of all the changing stories. Because not just one or two characters are going through these really extreme arcs. Almost all of them are. And interweaving those all together is, I mean, my hat's off to the whole writing room down in L.A. for what they managed to present. I think it's an amazing mythology that they've created and these amazing complex characters that they've presented to us.
You play a doctor of sorts on the show, and I know the there's a lot of layers. There's infectious diseases. There's all sorts of scientific ethical questions coming up. But how much research did you have to do when approaching this character?
I actually had to do very little research for this character. People like Jordan Hayes and Kira Zagorski and Billy Campbell, who play Sarah Jordan, Julia Walker, and my brother Alan Farragut, in season one and more so in season two, they actually had to deal a lot with the science. They had to, they had a lot of scenes and a lot of scientific jargon that they had to understand. In season one, my character was sick, and then he was a monster. He was not functioning as a scientist in any way in season one. And then, frankly, in season two, he's letting everyone else do the science. So I didn't have to. I mean, I researched the CDC. I researched virology. You know, I wanted to get kind of an overview. But in terms of specifics of how the science all works, I didn't really need to know that too intimately. I really do think Jordan Hayes and Kira Sikorsky were the two who really had to study it a little more.
I want to touch on something you mentioned earlier. You mentioned you were at presenting the Canadian Video Game Awards a couple years ago, and for those listening, you speaking of fandom, you're involved in another quite a large fandom in that you are a voice in Assassin's Creed. What's that experience like for you?
That's amazing. That fandom, like the video game world and Assassin's Creed in particular, in Assassin's Creed 3, I played the main villain, Charles Lee. So people who played Assassin's Creed 3 are pretty intimate with that guy. And then in subsequent Assassin's Creeds after that, I played various smaller roles. But I think I'm most known for Charles Lee in Assassin's Creed 3. And it's not only voice, actually. What's happening more and more these days is full performance capture. So we go in, we mocap, motion capture the character, and we voice it. And we're wearing a helmet that has a camera trained on our face to capture our facial movements. And then they build the character, even if it's not my likeness, they build the character onto my facial structure. So the technology is mind-blowing. And it's a lot of fun to work that way. I mean, we're all wearing black tights with reflectors all over them. So, yeah, at one point during any time I'm working a job as a mocap or performance cap actor, I look down at myself in these black tights, and I'm like, wow, I'm an adult, and this is my job.
Just the sort of day-to-day sort of schedule of doing work like that, how demanding can it get?
Well, you know, I think it's more demanding physically for the stuntmen, because we generally don't do our own stunts. All the action sequences are going to be, left to the stunt professionals. You know, and they have a pretty grueling physical job. The job as a performance capture actor, I mean, it's tough because things move really quickly. There are no setups and there's no time between scenes the same way as shooting film or television, where there's a lot of downtime to prepare between each lighting setup and each set shift. In mocap, you're in one studio and they can shoot everything, and you're not on a set because they're going to put the world in afterwards. So things can happen pretty fast and furious. So you have to become proficient at not only learning lines quickly, which is kind of the easiest part, but making strong choices very quickly, like analyzing the script you're given and making really strong and committed choices in a hurry because you don't have very much time. So that's where the challenge lies, I think.
Would you classify yourself as a gamer?
No, I wouldn't. I'm terrible. I am the shame of many of my gamer friends and many of my geek friends. I didn't grow up playing video games so much, and I'm really terrible at them, and I've tried, and it's really embarrassing sometimes when I go to a con and I'm sitting on a panel with a bunch of other performance capture actors, and they know everything about all the games out there. I don't so much, and I'm really inept at the controller even.
Why do you think...
Maybe one day I'll get better.
Why do you think Assassin's Creed in particular has become the phenomenon that it has? It sort of spawned a whole new genre and philosophy of gaming like we hadn't seen.
Yeah, well, I think a big part of it is the storytelling. It is a huge story. I know Assassin's Creed 3, the script for Assassin's Creed 3, I think was about 5,000 pages. I mean, including all the side missions and everything. That's an awful lot of storytelling. So it makes for a very rich environment for the writers to tell stories and for the gamers to immerse themselves in this world of rich characters. Because also the technology is becoming so powerful that the performances by the actors are there's a real faithfulness to the performance. So we are able to really find a richness of character within these games. And I think Assassin's Creed in specific is set up really well to take advantage of that, because you're meeting so many historical characters too. That's a big part of it, right? There's a serious learning curve within an Assassin's Creed game. You know, Assassin's Creed 3 was in the American Revolution, and then the last one that came out, Unity, is set in the French Revolution. And they go to great lengths, the designers and the creators of the games, to keep it as historically accurate as possible. And I think that's a big draw.
So... I don't know if there are, video game premieres, but how would you compare it, like the launch of Assassin's Creed versus the launch of a new movie or TV show?
Well, they're all a little different, right? The ones I've been involved in, Assassin's Creed 3, when we premiered that in Montreal, was a nice big party at a huge club and a lot of pomp and circumstance. I think Assassin's Creed Unity, I was down in San Diego for the Comic-Con last July. I went down with Helix because we did some press and panels down there. And Ubisoft had a presence also for the for promoting Assassin's Creed Unity, and it was huge. They had a whole parkour course set up outside, and it was a big deal. So a lot of resource and a lot of attention goes into these premieres. I had a fun little role in the last X-Men Days of Future Past and the world premiere down in New York City. That was mind-blowing. It was huge. I've never been to anything so lavish and extreme in my whole life. It is amazing. So they're all, you know, they're all different in their own ways. And then, you know, television shows, some will have a very quiet premiere. You know, they'll have, cast and crew for a private screening. And then, you know, a lot of the premiere press will be done online and social media. So it varies greatly between different projects.
You mentioned social media, and you know we were talking about mocap earlier. And how has technology and social media, in your mind, enhanced the entertainment factor for the fans? Would you say?
Greatly. It gives fans access to the creators, to the actors, to the designers. I know just in my experience alone of Friday nights, I try to, as much as I can, live tweet with the fans for the American East Coast showing of Helix. We just had our finale on Friday night, and tonight we have our finale Canada. But it's a new experience, right, to be able to interact directly, for example, with the actor, you know, and for the actor to be getting, you know, pretty direct feedback from what's happening on the screen, and having fans be able to tweet out at us and saying, "Hey, this is how we thought about that scene," or whatnot. It's mind blowing. I'm trying to think how I would have been back in the early '80s, you know, watching Chips or Dukes of Hazzard, and tweeting at Bo and Luke or something like that. You know, it's changed the game.
And it feels like, and I know here in Vancouver, there's a lot of talk about new media and, all that kind of stuff. And it seems like that's where a lot of television and film is heading. But I'm curious with your experience with video games and with Assassin's Creed, with technology where it's at, do you think it favors video games and sort of that style of art versus all else that's out there?
I don't think it favors it necessarily. I think it definitely enhances the experience across the board. You know, if you look at the state of television right now, or 10 years ago, 10 years ago, we had, a few networks, right? The major networks that we have creating original content. And HBO and, I think AMC was just starting with some things. But the landscape was fairly meager in terms of original content. Now you look at, it's sort of the democratization in a way of entertainment in that, the amazing shows that are on television right now, with AMC, HBO, Cinemax, FX, Netflix, Amazon, there's some amazing stuff coming out. And that's all because of social media and because of the new paradigm of dissemination of this content and how, different outlets will have access to audiences. So I think the whole paradigm's changing, and it's interesting to see how it's going to change in the next 5 to 10 years. I don't know if appointment television is going to be a thing of the past, but I don't know a lot of people who watch their show at 8 o'clock on a Thursday night anymore. Yeah. So that's one thing. I think it's amazing for video games. So I think, it is the fastest growing segment of the entertainment industry today is video games. You know, they make an awful lot of money, and they do some really amazing creative work. So I think it's a really exciting time for all platforms of BD right now and all entertainment.
And I know you're also an athlete. You mentioned that you played rugby, and I know that you play hockey as well. And I think I read that you played a variety of other sports as a youth. And how did being involved in athletics help you as an actor? Because I know you've spoken about that in the past.
Yeah, I find it really helpful. I mean, it's not something I really thought would necessarily, one way or another, I didn't think of it ahead of time. But I do find most of the training I have and most of the experience I have in playing contact team sports specifically, because that's, you know, what I always played, translates really neatly into my acting career, you know? A body awareness, you know, just fitness alone for, you know, some difficult, you know, action sequences that I'll have to do fairly often given the roles I play. And a coachability. I mean, I grew up being coached and being part of a team and kind of knowing my role within that team. And that's sort of ingrained in me. And I've really found that really helpful for doing my work on set, of being able to take direction and make it mine and run with it. And being able to know where I fit within the organism that is a cast. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's much like being on a team, you know, you can't do it alone. And that's something that athletics has instilled in me, is that, like, this is not a solo effort ever. I'm always counting on my teammates or my castmates, and they're counting on me. There's also, yeah.
Sorry, finish your thought.
Also, one of the really important things, and I think this translates more to my stage work than film and television, is that idea of being in the moment. I don't know if you hear actors talk about that, being in the moment. Well, that's something I know from sports. Because if I'm on the rugby pitch and I'm thinking about anything else other than what's happening right now and reacting to it, I'm going to get my collarbone broken. So I think athletes have a real innate sense of right here, right now. Forget about what just happened and don't think too much about what's going to happen. Just react to what's happening now. It's a valuable thing.
And finally, what can fans expect in the season finale tonight? And have you had any information yet about season three?
Well, first off, we've had no information about season three yet. I know that the people who have seen the finale down in the States, they're all dying to hear, because they want to see how everything moves along. I don't know if there's too much I can tease about the finale, other than there are some questions that fans have been dying to get answered, will get answered. There will be other storylines and other questions opened up as well tonight in the finale. I think it's pretty satisfying. I think it was a really fun and a really great way to end the season. It does not end as a series finale. It ends definitely as a season finale. So we're all keeping our fingers crossed that we do get a third, or else I'm going to wonder what happened with all these characters. But I'm sure fans are going to love it tonight.
Well, the season finale of Helix airs tonight on Sci-Fi, and I've been speaking with Dr. Peter Farragut himself, Neil Napier. Neil, thanks so much for your time today.
My pleasure, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And once again, that was Neil Napier, who is Dr. Peter Farragut on the show Helix. And the season finale, of season two, airs tonight on Sci-Fi. So tune in to that. It should be quite a lovely experience. Speaking of finales, the opposite of that, the premiere, as we all know, the premiere of Season 5 of Game of Thrones was last night. But four episodes did get leaked, so a lot of you are probably already farther ahead than the creators intended you to be. But that's what is happening right now with technology. Speaking of Game of Thrones, Maisie Williams is out with a great new movie coming out on April the 24th. Well, it's coming out in the UK. It doesn't have a North American release date yet. But if anyone wants to find a screening or find a way of hosting it, I really encourage you to. I've seen the trailer. It looks amazing. It's Maisie's first lead role in a feature film, and it's called The Falling, directed by a lovely filmmaker named Carol Morley. It takes place in the 60s, and it deals a lot with mass hysteria, and it's got quite a lovely cast. It's got newcomer Frances Pugh, maybe, is how you pronounce it. Lovely actress Maxine Peake, wonderful actress Greta Scacchi, and from Skins, season six, Joe Cole is in it, playing Maisie Williams' brother. So it's called The Falling, and it comes out at the end of this month, and I encourage everybody listening, whether you're in the UK, especially if you're in the UK, but anywhere else in the world, to check it out. It's going to be a fine, fine film. All right, moving away now from movies and entertainment and into the fields of education. Here in BC, for sure, there's been a lot of talk about education and our education system and class sizes being too big, and there not being enough, buildings, rooms, infrastructure, teachers, to really get the full educational experience. But there is a place in the world where people look to as a prime example of really, really, really good educational policy, and that's over Europe, Scandinavia, but particularly Finland. Finland has always been ahead of the game and on the cutting edge of educational policy, post-secondary. The pedagogical approach that they have towards education is really second to none. And late last month, there was a big sort of viral sensation about how they are going to do away with the teaching of subjects as the traditional model that we may know it here in North America. And rather they're going to teach by topic, and so I had a chance to speak with one of the people who's been pushing for this, not a reform, because Finland's kind of already been headed in this direction for many years, but one of the people who has been at the head of this new educational movement. He's an educator, and he is the development manager for the city of Helsinki, which is the capital of Finland. He is Pasi Silander, and I spoke to him from Helsinki a couple of weeks ago. On Skype with me now, all the way from Helsinki, it's Pasi Silander. Pasi, welcome to the program. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So I wanted to have you on because I recently read the article in The Independent about Finland's sort of new educational policy model that they're going with. And, well, I'll start with what Finland's at right now, because for years, sort of that area of the world, Finland, Scandinavia, has been known for its educational policy. What has made it so good, so effective for so long?
Of course, there's many factors, but I think the fact that we develop all the time our education system and pedagogy, so we all the time try to improve it and develop it. And I think that we also emphasize the value of education for the society and for the individuals. So education is kind of very high and very top priority in our society, because we don't have any kind of oil or natural resources. So expertise and education is our really kind of success factor.
In Canada, we have a saying that if it's not broke, don't fix it. And your system clearly works so well. Why did you make the decision that you guys did in changing it, dropping the teaching of subjects in favor of the teaching of topics?
We have the exactly same saying in Finland. And when someone objects to development in society or in organizations, she or he uses that saying as an argumentation. Well, my argumentation would be that we'll have to maintain the engine in order to keep it going. Actually, we don't have to drop all the subjects totally. And we haven't done it in the primary and in the upper secondary education. So we still have some classical school subjects, but there are also teaching based on the topics. So basically we have to pull. In the vocational education, there haven't been subjects for a couple of years. In vocational education, we have only the large entities or topics based on the working life. Topics can be like cafeteria services, so how to fix the engine in a car.
We don't have to fix our education system, but I think we have to maintain the engine. So we have to keep it going, and the idea is all the time to improve our system. Of course, the society has changed a lot, and so we have to change, of course, our educational system. Well, actually, we don't drop all the subjects. So we still have some subjects, and we still have some topics to learn and teach. So we change it bit by bit, step by step. But for example, in the vocational education, so there haven't been any school subjects for a couple of years. There's only large topics based on the working life, and that's very natural for the vocational education. But also in the high school and in the primary school, we want to emphasize that we have to integrate the different kind of school subjects together. And we talk about the topics, so learning by topics. And in the high schools, in Helsinki high schools, so a very big amount of teaching and learning is based on the teaching by topics. But still, we have also these traditional subjects.
What factors go into making a decision like this, whenever you make a big sort of change?
As we think that the education has to follow the modern society we are living in, and society has changed a lot. So we need a different kind of skills nowadays than we needed yesterday. And in the future, we need a totally different kind of skills. And we think that our task is to provide our students with the 21st century skills. So the basic skills they will need in life. And these 21st century skills are like seeing the holistic things, analyzation, critical thinking skills, and these kind of things. And we need a kind of this kind of topics to learn. And we also want to kind of increase the students' motivation and make the learning to be very meaningful. So that's why we have done the change.
On that note, I remember at least when I was in high school, you know, taking a variety of tests to determine, you know, what I would do, what kind of learner I would be. But there's a lot of criticism of that style, of that method. Why do you think that so many schools struggle to adapt to students' specific learning needs and styles?
There might be, of course, quite many reasons, but I think more or less these traditional structures of a school, of education, like subjects, classes, desktops, and even some pedagogical settings, they limit kind of how well we can take account of students' individual learning styles. And for example, some of the pedagogical settings has really kind of initiated about 100 or 1,000 years ago. But nowadays we know more about individual learning and how the learning is happening and about the human cognition. But these basic structures of the schools, they don't support the individual learning. If you think about the classes or classroom, they support only kind of collective ways of learning. But nowadays we know that these individual learning styles are very important. And if we want to change the pedagogy, so we first have to change the system, we have to change the structures of the schools, maybe even get rid of the classes, subjects, desktops, and so on. We have to change the whole system in order to change the pedagogy. And that's why it's so difficult.
And here in North America, there's been an increasing criticism of sort of the post-secondary standardized testing model. How do you see that playing a factor going forward? Do you think that that's going to get phased out entirely? Will it be adapted as the generations get older?
I would say yes and no. I think that we need some kind of standardized test and some kind of standardized testing, or we need a kind of evaluation culture for the skills for the students learn. But for example, in Finland, we have very few standardized tests. So in fact, we don't really believe on testing or culture of measuring. So more or less, we believe on pedagogy, and that's how we want to kind of make quality. So I think that the national curriculums we have, they are the quality factor. In Finland, we have this kind of national high school final exams, but that's only kind of standardized test we have, but really we don't have the culture of testing. And I personally believe that, of course, we have to evaluate the learner skills and kind of provide the framework how the skills are developed. But we really should kind of emphasize all to the pedagogy. So the learning methods and pedagogy is something that we need, and that helps the students and people to develop their own skills and own capacity for the future. That's what I believe.
On that note, you know, there's so much change happening in the world, whether it be, you know, social, political, environmental, religious. But from an educational standpoint, what is the biggest challenge, do you think, affecting the youth going forward?
I think the challenge is that skills are needed in the future are totally different than nowadays. And in the future, or even nowadays, we have different kind of professions, and we need different kind of expertise, different kind of professionals. For example, the digitalization of the industry and society has changed the professions a lot. We need a different kind of expertise nowadays, and I personally would kind of emphasize the need of the high-level thinking skills and creativity. So, of course, computers, they do the calculation, but humans have to do the thinking.
There's been a lot of different sort of schooling methods coming to the forefront. There's homeschooling. Lately, the unschool movement or learning by observation is gaining traction. So my question is, do we even need sort of the physical classroom models of school to acquire an education?
Of course, we will need a different kind of settings and different kind of systems. But in the future, I think we don't need any kind of physical classrooms or traditional school buildings. But I think more or less what we need is a kind of learning community and new pedagogy. So we need teachers to coach and scaffold students' learning processes. But I don't know if we have to talk about the schools or teaching. If we talk about the learning, so that's the most important thing. We talk about the learning in the future and then find all possible means to facilitate the learning and different kind of settings and tools.
You know, it strikes me that there just seems to be a fundamentally different approach between how they do things, in Finland and Scandinavia and Europe, versus how they do things in North America and the U.S. Do you notice any sort of fundamental differences between the two parts of the world? And would you maybe have any advice for us over here in the West?
Basically, I think that learning is kind of the same kind of process in all over the globe, but how we teach and teaching culture, it kind of differs a lot in different cultures and different countries. I have noticed some differences between Finland, Europe, and North America, but more or less I think that the education is always bound to the culture, and we don't have a one solution that we can just clone for the different countries. But more or less, I think that the most important thing is the pedagogical methods. So how the learning is happening, what kind of cognition is needed for the students. And when we focus and design our educational system based on the learning, based on the students' learning process, when we design and plan teachers' activities based on the students' learning processes, I think that's really the key issue. So that's maybe my advice, that we have to keep learners' learning process in focus.
Well, it's definitely, something that's not always been talked about a lot, but I applaud Finland for its bold move forward into this century and beyond, and we will continue to look to Finland for leading the way in education. Pasi Cylinder, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Alrighty, have a good one. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
And that was the development manager for the city of Helsinki in Finland, Pasi Cylinder, talking about the new model approach to education that Finland is going to be undertaking over the next few years. If you want to find out more, there's a great article that was done by by Independent, the newspaper in the UK, back in March, I believe it was. And it's called, back in March. Finland Schools, Subjects Scrapped and Replaced with Topics as Country Reforms Its Education System. It's a very, very good, not totally exhaustive, but it's very good at going into detail about what they're trying to do over there. And also there's another really cool thing in that article. There's an image board that's titled School Lunches Around the World, which is another interesting look at how different countries keep their kids healthy when it comes to education. For example, the photo in Brazil, it's rice with black beans, baked plantain, pork with peppers and coriander, green salad, and a seeded roll. The next picture is that of the lunch in the USA, and it is popcorn chicken with ketchup and mashed potato, green peas, a fruit cup, and a chocolate chip cookie. So we can see why there is a little bit of a health concern in the States. The Ukraine, not super healthy, but better. Borscht with pickled cabbage, sausages and mass, and a sweet pancake. UK, this is so British, I can't even. Fish cakes, Brussels sprouts, cabbage, rice with peas, and a yogurt parfait with berries. Sounds quite good. Spain. This, for all you foodies out there, this is food. Seeded roll, shrimp with brown rice, gazpacho, and tricolor peppers and an orange. That gazpacho looks delicious. South Korea, broccoli and bell peppers, fried rice with tofu, fermented cabbage, and fish soup, Greece, baked chicken with orzo, stuffed grape leaves, salad of cucumber and tomatoes, yogurt with pomegranate seeds and clementines. You get the idea. And Finland, because we were talking about Finland. a typical school lunch in Finland, according to this, is pea soup, carrots, beetroot salad, crusty roll, and sweet pancake with berries. Delicious. And something I can eat as a person who does not eat meat, a completely vegetarian lunch, which is something that I appreciate. Not that schools need to be exclusively vegetarian, but I think they should have a vegetarian option anyway, as it's something that's becoming more and more common, both here in the West and in a lot of places in Europe. Germany, for example, is really doing some remarkable things in terms of food, vegetarianism, veganism, everything like that. Anyway, that was a really long, winded explanation of saying, check out this article on The Independent about this this education thing going down in Finland. There's also another one on a website called zmescience.com /science Finland-education-system. The title is A Revolution in Education, Finland to Stop Teaching Individual Topics. And it even says, Finland, one of the educational hotspots of the world, is committed to a revolution in education by 2020. They will move on to a topic type of education. So they'll basically, what they're saying is they'll eliminating of what's the point of learning this type of question. So that's another great article, and that's on zmescience.com. And also, another thing to point out, in Finland, education is free at all levels, from kindergarten to graduate, just like other northern countries. Germany will soon join that. And the only countries that can kind of compare to Finland in terms of that are Singapore and sometimes China. And there's something called the International Student Assessment Rankings, or Program for International Student Assessment Rankings. So check that out. This is, once again, that is zmescience.com. Okay, I've rambled on long enough here today, but my thanks to Pasi Cylinder for joining me today all the way from Helsinki, and my thanks to Neil Napier from the show Helix. Once again, the season 2 finale of Helix airs tonight on the Sci-Fi Network. And for those Assassin's Creed fans out there, next time you're playing Assassin's Creed 3, the voice and motion capture of Charles Lee is none other than Neil Napier. And if you are a fan of the Assassin's Creed Unity, which is the one that took place during the French Revolution, he did the voices of both Victor and Hugo. Victor Hugo, who was the writer of the novel version of Les Mis and The Hunchback of Notre Dame and all those classic novels set during the French Revolution. I am out for today. Stay tuned next week. It's going to be a big show. I just got this, still working on the final confirmation, but I just got word today that this is most likely going to happen. An interview with renowned Canadian First Nations actor, activist. She recently won the Actor Award of Excellence at the Actress Ceremony in February. She's got a new movie coming out down here. I'm thrilled she's joining us. Tantu Cardinal will be on the show. Yes. So please tune in for that. All right. I'm sick of my own voice now. Thanks for tuning in, everybody, and we'll see you next week. Bye, everybody. Bye.